Blog Talk Radio.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keeve. I'm your host, Joy Keeve. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keeve, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keeve. And you can send me an email. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeeve@hotmail.com. I want to say thank you to all the listeners. We're past 700,000 downloads of the podcast. So I just want to say thank you for listening. I hope you have enjoyed the shows and shared with friends and family. I really appreciate your support. This really helps the show continue and get a lot of wonderful information out there. Today's show is another example of trying to get information out there about what's going on in the world. We are going to be speaking with a wonderful artist who has won numerous awards for her books, National Book Critics Circle Award, Matt Oprah Book Club Selection, American Book Award winner, Penn Faulkner Award finalist, and so on and so forth. Edwige Dandicott, good evening.
Good evening, Joy. It's so wonderful to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you again for coming on this evening. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're very busy, and you're doing a lot of work here and there and everywhere, so thank you for coming on this evening.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I want to mention just some of the titles. I mentioned some of your awards, but Brother, I'm Dying, one of the titles, Breath, Eyes, Memory, Crick, Crack, The Farming of Bones, The Dew Breaker, and today we're going to be talking about your book, Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work. So you have a lot of things under your belt. And later on this year, this is crazy how busy she is, she has another book coming out. We'll talk about that a little later, probably near the end of the interview. I want to let the listeners know you can call in 646-929-0368. Again, 646-929-0368. I thought about having her on the show, not that I hadn't thought before in the many years trying to get you on, but recently you wrote an article about immigrant detainees and their treatment. Did you know that 400,000 men and women and children per year are being detained by the United States? Why don't you talk to us just a little bit about your interest in this, other than just being an immigrant? I know your personal story, so I would like you to share that personal story you have about what happened with your uncle.
Well, you know, I've been interested in this issue for a very long time, Joy. Even, you know, when I was a young woman working my first job, I worked with a group called Artists for Democracy in Haiti. And one of the things that we worked against was the detention then in Guantanamo, you know, where they now have sort of the so-called worst terrorists in the world. They used to have Cuban and Haitians there who had been intercepted at sea. And one of the members of our group was Susan Sarandon, who read in public this letter that this mother had written, a woman named Yolande Jean had written to say goodbye to her children because she was HIV positive and was being detained in Guantanamo when she was seeking asylum. So I was always very active in this issue. But in 2004, it sort of came full home when my uncle, who is 81 years old and was a cancer survivor, was had to leave Haiti suddenly because there was a disturbance in his neighborhood, and his house was ransacked, his church was ransacked, and he had been coming back and forth to the United States for 30 years. But that day when they asked him how long he would be staying, he said he wanted temporary asylum because he didn't think he would be able to get himself back in the time that the visa allowed. And he was immediately arrested, detained, and his medication was taken away, and he died 5 years later in shackles in the prison ward of a hospital in Miami.
So how does this happen? What criteria is used to say whether someone is detained or not, considering he has been here so many times? What criteria is being used? And you mentioned about the beds available, and you say, you know, that this is maybe part of the reason, like, you know, people feel like they have to fill the beds, not necessarily because the person needs to be detained, but they're trying to reach some type of quota. I mean, talk to me about this criteria that's being used, or is there any criteria?
Well, it's a very complicated matter, because in my uncle's case and in many other cases, it was certainly at the discretion of many people along the way as to what they could do. For example, in my uncle's interview, they were asking him, are you a public person? Do you know Congress people? So they were all these questions that he was asked that seemed to indicate that maybe that there are different people along the way who could have made the decision. Now, there's been for a long time almost a double, triple standard for Haitian asylum seekers, that basically as soon as they request asylum, if you're Haitian, you're detained, you know, most of you know, so there's no recourse, immediately you're detained and speedily deported. And so there's that, you know, it's not often a clear criteria, but most people are detained, and then they go before a judge without any representation, whether they're children or whether they're disabled, mentally or physically disabled. They don't have any legal representation, so it's sort of a behind-the-scenes process. But there's also what you're referring to about the beds. There's something called a bed mandate that Congress requires that there are 34,000 or so beds for detainees in the United States, so that there's never a case, I suppose, where someone is like, oh, we let them go because there aren't enough beds. So a lot of detention places, you know, they see it as a mandate so that you have to have people in these beds. So what people who have been advocating this cause have said forever is that not every bed has to be filled. And there are cases, certainly, where people are not non-criminal asylum seekers or children, or people who have family members here, that there are other ways that they could do this. And for every person who's detained in one of those beds is $160 per day, and other means of monitoring and so forth cost something like $14 a day. We're not saying, and sometimes people distort, you know, like say, oh, you want everybody out. That's not what anybody's saying, because immigrant people live sometimes in the least safe neighborhoods, and nobody wants, you know, to be to have criminals out on the street. But sometimes people just throw it all in together, and there are cases that certainly could be handled differently, including a case like my uncle's.
Well, I think you've brought up this interesting issue, like immigrants. What comes to mind when somebody thinks of immigrants? I mean, it's this issue of what comes to mind when somebody thinks of who's on welfare. You know, when people think about who's on welfare, I mean, this is a stereotype. You know, they think black female mother. You know, when somebody thinks
single
of an immigrant,
mother,
single mother. You know, irresponsible, lazy. All these things, you know, adjectives come to mind. Unfortunately, when people think about immigrants, sometimes they have a very negative stereotype that, you know, they're just trying to take resources from us. And who is us? Well, you know, anybody that has that mindset. That if we allow certain immigrants in, then we are going to lose out on something, our jobs, our houses, our education. So there's this negative, you know, negative thoughts and words that are connected to, you know, being an immigrant, and then immigrant being criminal. And now with, you know, after 9/11, terrorists, immigrant equal terrorists, you know. So this is the problem with the mindset. But what you mentioned in the article about the alternatives are, you know, home visits, curfew restrictions, electronic monitoring, and that's the thing that you were talking about that costs about $14 a day. Has any place in the country started using those types of means, do you know of?
Well, there are, you know, with the sequester, now they've been forced to do it, you know, because there's the budget where the sequester forces something like 20% budgetary cuts. So that's gone across the wire down to immigration as well, and they've started releasing people that they could have released, you know, years ago under the same program, pregnant women, children who have family members here. But, you know, you raise an interesting point about these myths that people have about immigration. I think Americans sometimes are or generally a little bit schizophrenic about immigration in the sense that they'll say, you know, we're a nation of immigrants, but stay home, you know.
Right. Oh, my God. Is that not so hilarious? You know, like your grandparents, you know,
yeah,
they came
exactly.
and, you know, they've got an opportunity, a chance. But now that we're here and we're in second, third generation here, you know, now we're American. Now I'm going to hold up this flag. And, you know, like in Philadelphia, there's a cheesesteak place. There's like a huge tourist thing, the cheesesteak, and the guy wanted everybody to speak English. Mind you, his parents were immigrants, came here, couldn't speak English. But now he's like,
exactly.
You know, so it's like this crazy, like you said, schizophrenic, but you yourself were immigrant, now you're stopping the next person from coming in. What is that about?
Exactly.
You know?
And then, you know, when there's election time, people go up there on these you know, in front of their Republican or Democratic, whoever their group is, you know, and they say, my mother came here with $5 in her pocket, you know, from that, you know, pick your country, right? So there's that narrative of like, you know, we triumphed, we were immigrants, our parents were immigrants, but then they sort of detach this, like, you know, like, oh, and you know, immigrant is great, but as long as it's in the past. But I think we should also address these myths about immigration. You know, there are so many myths about immigration that immigrants don't pay taxes, when actually, you know, anybody who buys anything, if you go to the store, you buy something, and we pay property taxes, you're paying taxes, and then they end up using less of these. You know, and people, you know, they use welfare. People, if you're in the shadows, you're not going to be abusing welfare, you know. And so there's a lot of these myths, like, I think, you know, in general, and I'm not saying that because I'm an immigrant myself, I think people, immigrants generally contribute more to the society than they take in. You know, if you imagine this society, suddenly they're, you know, they took out everyone, how would this society function? I live in Miami, which is pretty much run by, you know, by immigrants. And so it's very, I mean, it's a duality that I think, you know, closer and closer people are starting to acknowledge that you have not just, you know, you have immigrants of mixed status. You have these children also who, the so-called dreamers, who came here when they were kids with their parents.
Right.
Some of them came in their parents' farm. Yeah, and then no other life. And so, and people want to deport them in some places. You know, these laws in Arizona that were so draconian that just wanted to push away everybody. And so it's something that I'm glad, you know, it seems like every couple of, every cycle or so that this country wants to deal with. And this time it seems like this reform, they're moving towards reform. We'll have to wait and see what eventually comes out of that. But it's an important conversation to be had. And it's also important to have in a political way, but it's also important to have in a way that we are trying to better understand our neighbors, you know, our immigrant neighbors and their children who are slowly becoming weaved into this society.
Yeah, I mean, we talked earlier, before we actually got on the air, about the interconnectedness of things. And, you know, we have to come to some kind of balance about the immigration issue. But I think one important point you just made earlier is not just in the political realm talking about immigration, but I think in the home talking about immigration. And again, dispelling myths, you know, who is an immigrant? We may be immigrants. We in this household, you know, when you're talking, we're immigrants, our grandparents, your grandfather, your grandmother, your aunt, your uncle, this, that, and the other, you know, because Native Americans were the ones that were here first. Everybody else came after, you know what I mean? So
exactly.
we were all immigrants at some place in time. I'm not saying that everybody should come in. There's no rules or regulations, but dispelling the myth at a more intimate level, I think, will be more powerful than just on this political propaganda. Because like you said, when it becomes time for election, all of a sudden somebody wants to claim they're immigrant, but that's just to get the vote. But when that's over, you know, they're like, let's build a wall. You know, let's have, you know, shotguns lining the borders or whatever. So
exactly.
It's like
racism and all these other isms. They fade a little bit when you actually know individual people, when you actually know individual stories. You know, when people are just not a color or face or slur to you, I think you interact with them very, very differently, you know. And there's so many stories of you know, the stories of success that people tell now, it's almost, you know, they wouldn't be possible if they were, if maybe certain people had gotten as much in the path of these immigrants, you know, these latter-day immigrants, as these people want to do now. And it's always, of course people get great benefit from being in this country. That's why they came. That's why their parents came. But also they give a lot, you know, they give a lot. And I think that's what sort of rarely acknowledged. It's sort of like you're here to take, but the fact that people are giving or contributing a lot is also not being acknowledged.
Well, I want to acknowledge you and a lot of things that you have given to us, the readers, all your wonderful books. I just want to read, this is from your book, Create Dangerously. It says, create dangerously for people who read dangerously. This is what I've always thought it meant to be a writer. Writing, knowing in part that no matter how trivial your words may seem, someday, somewhere, someone may risk his or her life to read them. And one of the questions that you ask is, how do writers and readers find each other in dangerous circumstances? Many immigrants are coming from dangerous circumstances. Many are coming from places where they're censored. And one of the things that I really like that you talk about is the censorship of reading and not even being able to read. And for me, I came from a home where there were books all over the place. Like, if you come into my house now, there's like a room of books, you know, because that's what I grew up with. And I can't imagine not being able to read freely, not being able to get ideas, not being able to dream or fantasize in my head, in my little world, under my pillow, under my covers, because then if this book is found, my family could be killed. You know, I don't have that experience. So, you know, talk to us a little bit more about that for some people who may not be aware of the level of censorship that was going on in Haiti during Papa Doc. And that you opened the book with a really powerful scene and historical information. But just talk about this censorship of books and reading.
Well, but you know, before we get to Haiti, when I was hearing you talk, I started thinking about Nikki Finney's acceptance speech at the National Book Award last fall, where she talked about, you know, her ancestors, who, you know, she's like she said, we begin with history, you know, and then the ones who longed to read and write but were forbidden, who lost hands and feet, were killed by laws written by men who believed they owned other men. Their words devoted to quelling freedom and insurgency, imagination, all hope. What about the possibility of one day making a poem, you know? And so that was the beginning of her National Book Award acceptance speech for poetry. And then she said, tonight these forbidden ones move all around the room as they please. They sit at whatever table they want. They wore camel-colored field hats and tomato-red kerchiefs, you know? So, you know, the ones who longed to read and write but were forbidden, who lost hands and feet and were killed. I was, like, bawling like a baby that night, like, listening to her through my computer screen, reading her because that's so much was done for us to do, you know, so much was given for us to have the opportunity to read freely, to create freely, you know. And that starts with, you know, she takes us way back there. I go to the people, the writers I admired, who during the dictatorship, you know, had to flee, had to hide. You know, one of them, a very famous writer, Jacques Stephen Alexis, was ambushed and murdered, and the book. And so that's the dangerous creation that sort of the book acknowledges. It acknowledges sort of Nikki Finney's ancestors and my ancestors, people closer to my life.
And my ancestors too.
Yeah,
and
your ancestors.
Because without the people before me, you know, I wouldn't be able to go to school, you know, not just because of racism or forgetting even that part, just like you said, getting your hands and your feet and brutalized because you were found with a book here in the United States under, you know, slavery.
Exactly, and that's not, so, in the spectrum of eternity, that's not such a long time ago. So I think those dangerous creations and thinking of that of people, like how, you know, how did Frederick Douglass learn to read? Like, I always, like, I'm moved always by that story. So I try in that book to just talk about people, you know, people in my history whose history is linked with that history, with your ancestry and Nikki's ancestry and my ancestry, all these things where people who wanted to create, you know, fought for it. And so these, you know, who also had a sense of independence, who had a sense of freedom, not just for themselves, but for others. And some of them fought in armies. And some of them, you know, like Numai Ndwe, who opened the book, you know, they were fighters. But others were artists, and that's how, you know, that's how they fought that war. You know, Alice Walker had this wonderful essay that I also mentioned in Credentials, called In Search of Our Mother's Gardens.
Right.
And she talks about sort of how would we have had Nina Simone under these circumstances, you know, and people, if you weren't able to be free enough to live, much less to create. So all of that, you know, when I started contemplating, it was sort of, in a way, for me, writing that book was almost like a way to say thank you. So thank you to all of these people who braved the way, who created under much harder circumstances than me.
Yes.
Yeah, and so it's sort of,
you know,
like the path that I follow.
That's the key right there. That's the key right there about how, you know, today we might complain about, you know, what we have to do, what we have to go through. But one of the things that you talk about is that in Haiti, and because people couldn't write freely, they would use the Greek classics kind of as a overcoat, kind of as a shield, you know, to get still the political word out. So they would manipulate Greek classics.
We had, you know, a poet named Félix Maurice Leroy who rewrote Antigone, you know, and staged Antigone. He rewrote it in Creole, and they could stage it in some ways while the dictatorship was there, because there were people in togas and everything. But the message was going forward. You know, you could see the dictatorship reflected in this art that was sort of centuries old. And so I think, you know, without sort of inflating our own egos as artists, it's just kind of like you could be doing the least important thing, but you could also be doing the most important thing without realizing it sometimes. And a lot of these writers, like Marie-Vieux Chauvet, who is this Haitian woman writer who's phenomenal, who had, you know, she used to have a meeting of writers called Les Araignées, like the spiders, meet at her house. And all of that was so...
That story made me cry. That made me cry a little bit.
Yeah,
story,
I know.
I was going to read from her thing about... okay, since you brought up her name, I'm going to read it. It says, I would like to be sure, she writes in Love, that Beethoven dies appeased that he has written his concertos. Without this certainty, what would be the point of the painful anxiety of a Cézanne searching for a color that escapes him, or the anguish of Dostoevsky grasping at God and the thoughts swarming within the hellish complexity of the soul? I mean, I was just like... and then for her,
isn't she brilliant?
Just,
isn't she brilliant? I mean, that's brilliant. Just hearing it from your mouth, I'm like, she's so brilliant. You know, we lost so much brilliance, and she died very young, and she could have written so much more. But, you know, in her time, she was, you know, that was how she was brave, was through her writing. And, you know, and then the daily things that she did, like gathering these writers at her house. But it was, you know, I just feel when I was writing that book, I just felt like what a phenomenal, you know, what phenomenal models. And, you know, women writers and women in general, we sort of, you know, we're always in search of mentors. When they are there, you know, they're there in our stories. They're there in our past.
Antigone is a rebel. Antigone was a rebel. She, you know, went up against Uncle Creon and buried her brother. And, you know, recently, it's funny that you had mentioned in the book, and then I was recently reading Antigone, and I was thinking about, like, other female rebels, like in Octavia Butler's book, The Pattern Master, and Amber being a rebel against, you know, the mind control and not being anybody's wife, and also her freedom of her sexuality. There are a lot of female rebels in modern literature that go against enemies of the state, if you will. But, you know, one of the characters, or not characters, but one of the artists, I should say, the radio host, I really connected with him because I'm a radio host, Jean-Dominique, you know, touching. Talk to his audience real quickly just about who he was, Jean-Dominique, and his story a little bit. We only have a few minutes.
Well, it's interesting because this will be the 13th year anniversary of his death, and there's an article today in the Miami Herald talking about his wife's constant search for justice. Jean was one of Haiti's most famous radio journalists. He, you know, he reported on everything from poison cough syrup to, you know, to people who grew sugar cane in the town where my family's from in Léogane. I mean, he was a very learned man, but also a very sort of down
Every
with the people man. And he used the radio to, you know, to tell other people's story. He was assassinated 13 years ago in front of his radio station with someone else who worked at the station. But he's, you know, the fight for justice continues for him. There's a film about him called The Agronomist that was made by Jonathan Demme that people can see to learn more about him. But it's a very powerful story, an unfinished story, because his family has not been able to get justice for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue. We're running out of time. There's so much that we could talk about, and you're going to have to come back on. But let's talk about your book coming out in August, I believe, this year.
It's called you know, you're gonna like this, Joy, because it's partly about the radio. There's a radio host who's kind of in it, who gets justice by exposing injustice. Her name is Louise George.
You have to make a movie, and I'll be the radio host.
And then you can star as Louise George in the movie. It's a book like Create Dangerously and the Story of Jean that shows sort of my love for radio, because in Haiti, radio it has such power. But this book is set in this small sea town, and the little girl Claire, Claire Limia Lame, which means Claire of the Sea Light, goes missing one night, and it's sort of a mystery that follows until we find her, and then it goes to all these people in the town who are connected to her. But I wanted, when I was writing it, I was like, I so wanted to write a book that was like a radio show. So this book has so much radio in it that I, you know, it's like your kind of book, I would imagine.
Oh, definitely. Well, I mean, we could do a reading. Like, you know, they had the old-fashioned, they would read the plays, and then you had to have that in your Create Dangerous, in reading the play on the radio.
That's something I used to do with Jean. Some of the stories in my book, Creek Crack, we did as radio plays for his and his wife's radio station. So, I love radio and its power. And now with what you're doing, the fact that it's on the internet and people can just tap in, I mean, I think it's an extraordinary medium that the work that you're doing just takes to another level, because we can sort of tap in whenever we want. And so I think, because I grew up with so much radio, it's a medium that I found extraordinarily powerful and inspirational.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I was drawn to it. Somebody interviewed me, and then I was like, wow, do you know what this means? That you can enlighten and share with thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And that's what I've been able to do, and I've learned so much along the way. And some of my shows are very political and probably going against the United States government, and some are a little more, you know, easygoing, so to speak, or light fare, if you will. But there is so much power and connectivity. I've learned and met so many wonderful, extraordinary artists and activists by doing the show. And so it's just been a blessing. And, for example, I'm talking to you right now. This is a blessing today to be able to talk to you about what you're doing and your work and enlightening people about dispelling myths. We're creating new myths now, you and I, talking.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And how great that you could do this on your own. I find that phenomenal. Like, you know, it's sort of more ways of channeling our stories, getting our voices heard. Kudos to you. I really appreciate what you do as well.
Oh, thank you. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. I'm going to be giving away some of your books. People need to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter, become a fan on Facebook, and you can win a copy of Create Dangerously. You have to come back later in the year.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah,
we're going to set that up, definitely. So thank you again, and I hope you have a wonderful evening, and just bless you and much continued success.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I really appreciate you tuning in tonight. Again, I'll be giving away some of her books, but one of them definitely will be Create Dangerously, but you've got to follow me at Joy Keefe, become a fan on Facebook. You can also send me an email. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeefe@hotmail.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. Tomorrow night, I'll be doing a Twitter chat about autism. The hashtag is SMJKAutism. That's on Twitter at 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, April 18th. And on Saturday, the 20th, I'll be talking about mindfulness to reduce stress with Augusta Hopkins. So hope you can tune in. Have a wonderful evening.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number 1 albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks, it's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.